In January 2009, celebrated author and activist Jeff Halper gave a press conference surrounding his views on the invasion of the Gaza Strip. This is part one of a three-part series.
So, maybe I'll just say a few words and then we can have more interchange, questions, answers, whatever. I'm the head of, as you can see from the brochure, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, which is an Israeli peace and human rights organization. It was established in 1997 when the Oslo peace process was in a state of collapse. You know, in 1996, the Israeli public voted in Netanyahu for the first time, because I think next month he's coming back. And Netanyahu ran for office on an explicitly anti-peace process program. In other words, Netanyahu is on record until today as being against any Palestinian state, even against autonomy for Palestinians. It's not clear exactly what he wants, but it's clear that the idea of a viable sovereign Palestinian state is completely unacceptable to him. So when he was elected, sort of in the middle of the peace process, it was clear that that peace process, if it had ever existed, was over. And in fact, we know that over the 7 years of negotiations between 1993 and 2000, Israel doubled its settler population. So if the idea was two states, a Palestinian state next to the state of Israel, it was clear that that wasn't going to happen. That wasn't in the Israeli intentions at all. And I think until today, I think the Israeli view is we can win. We can beat the Palestinians. It's a win-lose equation. Because we have to remember that Israel is really a military state. It's run basically by generals. It has a very military approach to things, as you can see today in Gaza. And the idea is that our military strength, plus, of course, the fact that Israel has this absolutely uncritical support of the United States, and you can throw Canada into that as well, and Europe, which is very complicit, Europe is not taking an independent stand, also gives Israel the confidence of believing that it can pull this off. And so where Israel is really going, and you have a little map of this brochure, is towards a Bantustan. In other words, we use explicitly the apartheid language. And this is really where Israel is going. In other words, towards a Palestinian entity. I wouldn't call it a state, really. It'll be called a state because, you know, the international community is kind of committed to the two-state idea. But the actual two-state idea, is more this map in the center. And in the two-state concept that is the concept of the international community all these years, there would be a Palestinian state emerging alongside the state of Israel. Now, it's not a just solution, because as you can see, the occupied territories, the territories occupied in 1967 by Israel, the West Bank, East Jerusalem is in there as well, and Gaza, only represent 22% of the country. So when we talk about a two-state solution that the Palestinians have accepted, 20 years ago, before Oslo, the Palestinians accepted the idea of a two-state solution in which the Palestinian state would be on less than a quarter of the land. Even though today the Palestinians are half the population of this country. So we often hear about Barak's generous offer. We never hear about the Palestinians' generous offer. Of saying we're willing to give up 78% of our country for a state on the other 22%. And Israel says no, because we're continuing our settlement projects, because we want to basically control the entire country, both for nationalist reasons, and that's where the settlers come in, but also for security reasons. Because the Israeli military people have a concept of security that's so encompassing that it leaves no breathing space for Palestinians. For example, in the Israeli military doctrine, the Jordan River between Israel and Jordan has to be Israel's security border. So that from the very beginning, before you even get into negotiations, already a policy is set in which any Palestinian state has to be completely encircled by Israel, which obviously means that there's no sovereignty. If Palestinians have no border with an Arab country, there's no sovereignty, there's no economic viability, and so on. And so where we are today, all right, let me just say that then when Netanyahu was elected, we of the Israeli peace movement began to re-engage with resisting the occupation. You know, many of us, you know, we're Israelis. And so we in a sense, had the same hopes of the peace process that other Israelis had. Here, at least the sides are sitting down in Oslo, they're negotiating with each other. Maybe something will happen. When Netanyahu was elected, it's clear that it's over. I mean, the Israelis elected an explicitly anti-peace process government. And if there's any message that I try to get across to people, including Israelis, is that we have to start taking responsibility. This conflict is not only because of the Palestinians. It's not Palestinian resistance. It's not Palestinian refusal. We elected a government in the middle of a peace process that was against and undermined the peace process. And if today Hamas is the strong political element, is the elected government of the Palestinians, it's because the so-called moderates, Arafat, Abu Mazen, the whole Fatah movement, never got anything, either from Israel or from the international community. In fact, the occupation got worse and worse and worse until finally, with an intifada even, until finally we reached the point that we are today. And so Israel is the occupying power. Israel is the only state. Israel is the strong party. Israel controls, with the United States and the West, the negotiating process. And therefore, Israel carries the lion's share of responsibility. Not to say Palestinians have no responsibility, but this isn't an equal, symmetrical game of both sides. Both sides, no. There's really one side that carries the lion's share of responsibility. So that Israel believes that it can succeed in establishing a Palestinian Bantustan. The idea being, all right, you want a Palestinian state? Canada is for a two-state solution? Fine, we'll give you a two-state solution. This is it. So we'll have a Palestinian state on 15% of historic Palestine. In other words, Israel expands from 78 to 85%. The Palestinians don't get even the 22%, less than a quarter. They get 15% of the land, and that's truncated into four what we call cantons. Three cantons in the West Bank and then Gaza. And that's what Israel, which is an apartheid solution. This is apartheid. And this is what Israel is trying to push in what's called the Annapolis process today. I mean, everybody has kind of laughed off the Annapolis process. It's seen as a failure, but it's still the process. And this is where Israel is going. So that today, the only effective source of resistance against the Israeli attempt, not just the occupation, but the attempt to make the occupation a permanent regime of apartheid, the only effective resistance is Hamas. You know, not Fatah anymore, that's become even collaborationist with Israel. And that's why I think the Palestinians, in their desperation, because they never, ever, ever were able to get anything either out of Israel or the international community through negotiations, went to Hamas to resistance. They might even know it's a losing battle. We have in Jewish Israeli history, Masada, where at some point you say, you know, the hell with it. We're just going to resist even if we know we're going to lose. Maybe. But I think that the Palestinians have been forced into this situation, and therefore what's going on in Gaza today is an attempt at pacification on two levels. One is to break Hamas, and this is a goal that Israel has said very explicitly, to break Hamas as a resisting force, which I don't think Israel can do. I think Hamas has become kind of a concept, like Nelson Mandela is much more than just the leader of South Africa. He has a symbolic importance that goes way beyond South Africa. I think it's the true of Hamas as well. I think Hamas, for the Muslim world, from Nigeria to Indonesia, the billion or so Muslims, for them, Hamas represents the clash of civilizations from the Muslim perspective. In other words, trying to defend Islam and the rights of Muslim peoples against neocolonialism, against imperialism, against apartheid. And therefore, Hamas is becoming, I think, a global Muslim phenomenon that can't be just defeated in Gaza. If anything, it's going to be strengthened by its fighting in Gaza. But that's one, but I'm telling you, that's the Israeli approach. Israel thinks it can win. It can beat a people militarily. And I don't know if that's ever really happened, unless you have genocide. You can't beat a people. And that's the second level. The second level of the Israeli attack, I think, is against the Palestinian people itself. In other words, what Israel says to the Palestinians is, we're going to hit you until you get the message. And this is a phrase that's repeated constantly, until you get the message. And the message is zero tolerance. This is our country, the Israeli Jewish country. This is the land of Israel. And we'll tell you what you're going to get. We're not going to negotiate with you. We're not going to certainly get any dictates from you. You'll get what we tell you, and you have no right to refuse. And if you do, we'll kill you. It's really this zero tolerance kind of a message, because, and this is something that's been lost in the media, but it's very important, because it hasn't been publicized a lot. Israel, but this has come out in Haaretz newspaper, so it's on the record. Israel is fighting in Gaza by what are called the Georgia rules. You know, the military has its own arcane language and so on. And somehow, if you give a title to a policy that completely violates all norms of human rights, it legitimizes it, because now it's a military doctrine or something. The Georgia rules are the rules that Russia adopted when it invaded Georgia, you know, a number of months ago. And that is what Russia said, and what Israel is saying explicitly in the Georgia rules is, in urban warfare, you cannot make a distinction between civilians and combatants, which is a fundamental distinction in the rules of engagement in warfare. It goes back even a couple hundred years, this kind of a concept, and it's fundamental to human rights. The inadmissibility of attacking civilians and non-combatants. The Georgia rules say no. In urban warfare, you can't make that distinction. In urban warfare, which is a part of counterinsurgency, there isn't an army. The Palestinians don't have an army. They don't have people in uniform. There isn't, you know, you're fighting the people, just like in Iraq and in Afghanistan. This is the new form of warfare that we're engaged in. I mean, although it had its antecedents in the colonial times as well. And therefore, the Georgia rules say, since you can't distinguish between civilians and combatants, an army has two ultimate goals. One is to achieve its military mission, and the second is to protect its soldiers. And trying to protect civilians that are caught in the middle of all of this, or trying to distinguish between civilians and combatants, only hampers the ability of the army to fulfill its mission and protect its soldiers, and therefore you can't do it. So in a sense, so this is really a war against the Palestinian people, not only against Hamas. But another important thing that I think has to be stressed is that this is a precedent. You know, urban warfare is the cutting edge of warfare all over the world. This is what the United States is investing in, what Israel invests in, this whole idea of counterinsurgency, urban warfare. For the first time in history, where we are today, the majority of human beings live in cities. And this is where this idea of urban warfare, because armies always tried to avoid cities. But now this is where they're bringing the battles into the cities. And Israel, because it has a laboratory. I mean, what country has a laboratory of 4 million people that can do anything it wants to with? 40 years now, Israel has been day and night in the Palestinian cities and towns and villages, in the West Bank and Gaza. Does anybody know what Israel's done every night? What kinds of weaponry they've developed? What kinds of tactics they've developed? The Palestinians are guinea pigs in this new approach to urban warfare that people aren't very aware of. And Gaza, in a sense, in the bigger sense of things for Israel, in what we call Israel's security politics, where Israel earns its place at the table with the big boys, in terms of being involved in global military ventures, is that it has the experience in the field of counterinsurgency and urban warfare that for all these years, for decades now, and is able to contribute in a way that other countries that don't have laboratories can't. In other words, Israel has, that's what gives Israel that edge. And if you're developing weaponry, and Israel's using all kinds of weaponry now that we're not familiar with, which is something that's also being hidden, including all kinds of phosphorus bombs and other sorts of things in Gaza. You know, when Israel goes to to all these military shows to sell its wares, field-tested in Gaza, field-tested in Nablus, wow, that carries a lot of weight. I mean, this isn't just some idea of some technocrats. And so I think we have to also understand what's happening in Gaza in a much more global way. Israel sees itself as a global military player on the side of the United States and Canada, which is on the side of the United States in a Bush sense. And from that point of view, I think it has a global agenda that we also have to understand in terms of what's going on in Gaza. So I'll leave it at that. And
I take it you're doing this all across Canada. But why?
Right.
Why are you bringing this message to Canadians?
Well, as Canada goes, the rest of the world goes. Well, maybe. One of the problems is in this whole thing. You know, fear is a great way to manipulate people. And one of the problems is that the Israeli public has been neutralized by its own government. In other words, the Israeli people have been told by all the political leaders, from the right to the left, including Barak, who's the head of the Labor Party, that there is no political solution. You know, it's the clash of civilizations thing. They're just Arabs. Barak said at Camp David, I unmasked Arafat as for the terrorist he is. There is no political solution. And therefore, the Israeli public has been disempowered. In other words, the Israeli public says, we want a real two-state solution. We do want to get rid of the occupation. The Israeli public has never bought into the greater land of Israel idea or the settlements. They've never done that. But they say, we can't make peace because the Arabs won't let us. See, we're out of Gaza and they throw rockets at us. Not really understanding that we've never been out of Gaza. But as Israeli peace activists, our group, not every group does this, our group has decided strategically that the only way to move things is through what we call international advocacy. Going abroad, it's only international pressures that are going to force Israel in the end to give up the occupation. And then the problem is that governments will not act on their own. I mean, if we're waiting for governments to do something, forget it. And so what we have to do is mobilize the people. So here I'm in Halifax and in Canada, and I travel all over the world to mobilize trade unions, what we call civil society, you know, churches, political and human rights groups, university groups, in order to create an awareness of this and to create some groundswell from below that will then get to the governments. Because if the governments don't see that there's a constituency for this kind of a just peace in Israel-Palestine, they're not going to do anything, because to be pro-Israel is a safe place to be. So we have to change that perception, and then to try to, and then it very much replicates the anti-apartheid movement. I mean, if it had been up to governments, there'd still be an apartheid regime in South Africa. It was only by mobilizing the civil society that was able to change, and that's in a sense why I'm doing this, because I'm trying to get to the people in order to get to the governments in order to make some change in policy.
So what is that change you're trying to affect? What do you see as a solution?
Well, that's...